Hello. Good afternoon, people. My name is Joel Nana, and I work for the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission. Today, we have a session on hidden reality and forgotten truth. On our panel today, we have four distinguished gentlemen from various parts of the world. I will start with Boris Dietrich, who is the Advocacy Director of the LGBT program at Human Rights Watch. He is a former member of the Parliament in the Netherlands. Boris Dietrich sponsored the same-sex marriage bill, the first one in the world in the Netherlands. He is a former member of the board of the Dutch National AIDS Foundation. And on my right, Magdalene Kobina. Magdalene is the executive director of the Center for Popular Education and Human Rights Ghana. He is a long-time human rights activist and one of this year's Red Ribbon awardee. And the gentleman just walking back to his seat is Ashok Rao Kavi. He's an 18-year-old. He worked 18 years as a journalist in India for publication, and then as a gay activist and founder of India's first gay news magazine, and then as founder chair of the Human Om Safa Trust, India's oldest gay NGO. Now working in UNAIDS as the desk officer for MSM and transgender and National Policy and Strategy Planning Officer for India's National AIDS Control Organization since 2006. He is a member of National AIDS Council. And the first presentation today will come from the gentleman in the middle. His name is Zorian Kis. He is the MSM Advocacy Officer at the All Ukrainian Network of People Living with HIV. Please help me in welcoming Zorian.
Dear colleagues, hello. And before I start my presentation, I would like to thank the organizers of this session for kind invitation and for opportunity to speak about the MSM issues. And I think it's very important to speak today, not about just MSM in general, but about MSM in my region and my part of the world. So I will now try to start my presentation, but what I see here is, here it is. So my presentation title is HIV Prevention, Care and Support for MSM in a Post-Soviet Country, Fight It with All Stereotypes and New Realities. So the structure of my presentation will be pretty simple. I will start with key facts about the country, then I will proceed with key head facts about the HIV epidemic in my country and HIV epidemic among MSM in my country. Then I will speak about some statistics and data we have, or we actually don't have in Ukraine. Then I will speak about Global Fund and other donors as agents of change. Then I will speak about homophobia as an issue in my country, and I will wrap up with lessons learned. So key facts about my country. This is a country in Eastern Europe, obviously, and its closest neighbors are Belarus, Hungary, Moldova, Poland, Romania, Russian Federation, and Slovak Republic. It's a country of the size of France, and with a population of 46 million, which has declined by 2 million for the last 5 years for various reasons, and HIV is not the last of them. It's a middle-income country, according to the World Bank, and it's the 29th country for its gross domestic product in the world, but it's only the 83rd country in the world for GDP per capita. Ukraine gained its independence in 1991, 17 years ago, but it's still struggling with its Soviet past. what is the HIV epidemic like in Ukraine? Since its first registration in 1987, more than 122,000 HIV incidents were registered in Ukraine. But as you can see, the estimated number of HIV-positive people is much bigger. It's almost 400,000 people. That means that 70% of them don't know they are actually HIV-positive. And the estimated HIV prevalence in Ukraine is almost 1.7% in adult population, which makes it the worst and the fastest growing epidemic in Europe. So how many MSM are there in Ukraine? We have done some researches and surveys, and the estimate is between 177,000 and 430,000 MSM. Of them, more than almost 41,000 of them are HIV positive, and this is almost 17% of the whole male population that lives with HIV in Ukraine. I would like to apologize for the amount of data and numbers I am presenting, but I think it's essential for us to understand, to compare it with our realities and our knowledge and our experience. In Ukraine there is no sentinel surveillance or any other researches among gay and other MSM. As we have heard on this conference, this problem is not unique for Ukraine. Gay and other MSM would rather misreport their mode of transmission than admit their sexuality, which is an obvious indicator and consequence of stigma and discrimination. So as you can see, only 159 incidents of homosexual, so-called homosexual transmission, has been officially registered in Ukraine within 20 years. And vast majority of them were registered before 1994 or after 2005. National data on modes of transmission are not disaggregated by hetero and homosexual modes, and large number of infections are reported as unexplained transmission. In Ukraine, there is no, I have spoken about this earlier, there is no research in Ukraine, and we don't actually know what the epidemic is like in Ukraine among MSM. First survey that can give us any initial idea about what the epidemic is like among MSM in Ukraine has been done last year, 2007. And here on the left part of the slide, you can see its results. My organization, the All Ukrainian Network of People Who Live with HIV, has also done testing in 4 cities in Ukraine, and its results are presented on the right part of the slide. And I would like to draw your attention to the fact that data of those two researchers correspond for corresponding cities. As you see, the epidemic is mostly on the west of Ukraine and on the south, but not in the center, in the capital city of Kyiv. No statistics, no problem. This phrase has been indicative for Ukrainian government's response to many issues, including HIV among MSM. National data do not actually reflect the epidemics among gay men and other MSM in Ukraine. MSM remain invisible due to no national sexual behavior service ever done. Historically, since 1995, the epidemics in Ukraine was driven by intravenous drug use, and naturally, most resources were and are directed to respond to this epidemic. However, in the 21st century, the incidence among IDUs is significantly dropping in favor of sexual transmission. naturally the capacity of NGOs that work with MSM is significantly lower than the capacity of those NGOs who respond to the epidemic among IDUs. Ukraine is well known for its political instability and continuous governmental changes. However, this political instability has given us, the civil society, a chance to respond to the epidemic and to assume full responsibility for it. Current Minister of Health is even finally now concerned that NGOs do what the government was supposed to do. In 2006, when the Ukrainian national proposal has been developed to the Global Fund, its sixth round of funding, MSM were recognized as a vulnerable group for the first time, despite the fact that the lack of epidemiological data was used against it. This was only possible because four leaders of gay community were present at the stakeholders meeting where this strategy was developed. They were also the members of proposal development group. I would like to touch the issue of homophobia, but before I have to admit that I am now stuck in the wires down here. So would you mind? Yeah. Thank you. So in 1991, Ukraine was the first former Soviet Union republic that decriminalized homosexuality. The condemnation of sex between adult consenting men was removed from the criminal code, but it was not removed from all other parts of legislation, which is 95% of legislation in Ukraine. It still remains in most instruction for the police, which is called militia in Ukraine, for statistics committee and other institutions. The statistics committee has to collect data on how many crimes were committed by MSM in Ukraine. On this picture you can see a leaflet of a fast food chain, and if it can produce such a leaflet in Ukraine, it is an indicator of something. Police, medical professionals, media, government officials, other public opinion leaders become more vocal about in their homophobia as the community becomes more visible. Unfortunately, homophobia exists not only in the environments that we believe are naturally hostile, but also in the environments that one would expect to be tolerant and supportive, such as the third sectors and NGOs. However, working together with partner NGOs can bring the difference, and it does. We cannot provide an adequate response to the epidemic unless we have a community. We know that sex between men exists everywhere, but it does not necessarily mean that there is a community which can stand for its rights and respond to the epidemic. In many parts of the world, this community has to be created out of nothing. The funding we have in Ukraine is not only used to provide services, but also to mobilize and create the community. I will now proceed with the lessons that we have learned in our work. So the first obvious lesson is that the evidence is essential for a successful advocacy work. The support of the major funders such as the Global Fund and the Elton John AIDS Foundation has been crucial to our work. A civil society is a powerful tool even in an unfriendly environment. Visibility and presence are key to success. We have to be visible and present. Lifting of criminalization of homosexuality is not the end of the process, although it has to be done in many countries yet. It is just the start of our job. Equality for gay men and MSM is impossible without positive provisions in anti-discrimination legislation. We can remove it from the criminal code and other parts of legislation, but equality will not exist without an anti-discrimination legislation. As we have heard on this conference before and on the MSM pre-conference earlier, human rights and response to HIV epidemic have to be integrated. An adequate response to the epidemic is impossible without a community. Here are my contacts. I would also be happy to share my business cards afterwards. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Zorian. We have decided to take all the presentation. Every presentation will be 15 minutes each, and at the end of the presentation, we'll have 15 minutes for questions. So the next presentation, which was supposed to be the first, is Magdalene Kobina from CPEC Ghana. He will be presenting on overcoming homophobia, violence, stigma, and discrimination as a way to promote HIV prevention among men who have sex with men in Ghana. Magdalene.
Good afternoon. The title of my presentation is Overcoming Homophobia, Violence and Discrimination as a way to promote HIV/AIDS prevention among gay men in Ghana. So my name, and I'm from the Center for Popular Education and Human Rights Ghana. I have to state here the background before the project started. Our project, MSM project, started in 3 years ago. But before the project started, we have no talk of condoms, no talk of lubricants, and no talk of STI treatment among the MSM community in Ghana. Our mission is human rights one, to create accountable and strive for the full attainment of equal rights, and we seek to inform, educate, counsel and support people in matters relating to law, health and socioeconomic well-being. Our aims and objectives, one is human rights. We also do gender sensitization, HIV and AIDS, democracy and good governance, and also partnering with other organizations to abolish socio-cultural practices that infringe on the rights of marginalized people. These are some of our current programs. We do human rights programs. We have young people's human rights programs in schools and communities. We also have the Sisters of the Heart program, which talks about, which deals with empowering women and lesbian women for in this matter. We also have, they do breast cancer and cervical cancer screening and other HIV/AIDS STI related services. We have the MSM HIV/AIDS intervention, which I'm going to talk about. One component of it is the training of peer educators. We also have the STI services at the CPEC drop-in center. And then we have the LGBTI intervention programs, and also do fight for against blackmail and extortion, which is big in the Ghanaian LGBT community. We also have educational and information center in our office, and we also provide video services and library services. We also organize film festivals. The methodology and the techniques we use, the name is Center for Popular Education, and we use popular education methodology in most of our activities in Ghana. We also use the peer education approach. We also use interactive theater, or the popular theater we call it. And we also use invisible theater within the communities on the streets of Accra. We also use workshops, talk shops, and we also show movies, and we have film festivals, distribution of condoms. Just to talk briefly about HIV/AIDS prevalence in Ghana. It tells you the areas in Ghana and then the HIV/AIDS prevalence. But among this area, MSM, the prevalence of HIV/AIDS among MSM in Accra and Tema is 25%. This is a research conducted in 2006 between CPEC and SHARP and MEDE with funding from the US. We asked why MSM are the marginalized, and this slide tells you about how the MSM population bridge into the general population and the special groups we have within MSM. This talks about the project objectives. One of the project objective is to increase awareness of HIV/AIDS and also prevention behaviors among MSM. Friendly drop-in center services. We also established referral network. And this one, we have to say, acknowledge the fact that CPEC working with other partners, which is the Ghana Health Services, have established 5 hospitals, friendly hospitals within Ghana where MSM work into for services. And we also promote the key behaviors among MSM, which is proper condom use and lubricants, getting tested and knowing your status, promptly seeking STI services, disclosure of status, STI status and HIV status to help your partner also go and test, and then adherence to treatment. We also promote faithfulness and partner reduction. The project started in 2005, and up to date we've trained we work in 11 communities or sites in Accra, in the Greater Accra region, which is Accra and Tema. And then we have informal activities within some parts of Ghana. We train 7 peer educators now, but we've first trained 10 peer educators, so we've so far trained 17 peer educators. And then we talk about our collaboration with the Ghana Health Services. And also, we have a system of, we call it text me, call me, chat me, where we send messages to MSM on their phone, mobile phones, to reinforce the messages that the peer educators send to them in their communities. We have some of our targets and then actuals to date. I must say that we've achieved most of our targets. One of the difficult areas is people who show up at the centers for treatment and for testing. And then we linked it to the existence of homophobia, stigma within the community. So people do not feel comfortable walking to the community, to the drop-in center for services or to the friendly service centers. We have a monitoring and evaluation system. We meet weekly to evaluate the processes within the communities. We look at the challenges that the peer educators are facing. And then the project coordinator, the supervisor, visits, do field visits. We have our funders also visiting frequently. And then we have a monthly monitoring and reporting, report writing system to our funders the lead funder is the Academy for Educational Development through the SHARP project. And then we document most of our activities. So now when you come to Ghana, there are other organizations that are helping, working with MSM in Ghana, because we documented the first phase and the second phase of the project. Key achievements to date. There's now increase of awareness of HIV/AIDS among the MSM community. And then we've developed materials, appropriate materials for MSM specific. Established the first ever drop-in center. And we've also had a behavior surveillance survey study last year, which shows that 25% of MSM are positive in Accra and Tema. We also working with 11 health personnel in 6 government hospitals who have been sensitized to provide HIV/AIDS related services. We've so far reached 2,305 MSM with educational materials, referral services, and others. Our challenges have been with the law, the section 29 of the Criminal Code of Ghana. It's an old British law which says MSM, homosexual activities, is unnatural under the Ghanaian laws. We've also suffered a lot of stigma and discrimination and homophobia within our communities. We also have the problem with self-stigma, where MSM feels it's my fault. I deserve to be discriminated against. I deserve to be beaten. We have problem with lack of funding for our programs because most people do not want to put money into our programs. And then we also have a challenge with high cost of STI drugs. So you see friends with prescriptions in their notebooks, and they don't, because they can't buy these drugs at the pharmacy. We have lots of denials by friends, family, and our pastors, religious leaders. I sat in the internet cafe with my pastor, and he never looks at my face. I called him several times, and he pretended he never met me before. Lessons learned. We've learned that it's possible to implement HIV/AIDS program in a hostile environment such as Ghana. And we've also, MSN have learned to seek early treatment. They've also accepted, we've accepted ourselves and HIV/AIDS treatment programs. When we first started, MSN think, people think we are BNI, we are with the security agents, getting them, trying to get them arrested. But now they've accepted the fact that we are one of them, and we are here to help. And also MSM, peer educators and MSM have learned to overcome stigmatization within the communities. We collaborate with some of these organizations in our work. And we also want to acknowledge our donors. Our main donor has been the Austria Lesbian Foundation for Justice. And recently we also received some funds from AMFA MSM initiative to buy lubricants and condoms. You can contact us. We are in Accra, an email. Midasipa, thank you for listening.
There seems to be a consensus that stigma and discrimination foils HIV and AIDS. And to try and find tools to address this issue, I would like to call on stage Boris Dietrich, who is the Advocacy Director at Human Rights Watch. He will present to us the Yogyakarta Principle, which is a tool that has been developed by international experts on human rights to address human rights violations on the basis of one's sexual orientation or gender identity. Thank you, Boris.
Thank you very much, Joel. Thank you for being here, all of you. When I received the invitation and people who invited me told me the title was Forgotten Truth, Hidden Realities. Actually, I thought, why is that the title? And why not, for instance, Forgotten Realities and Hidden Truths? Because when you come and think about it, and when you talk about sexual orientation, about homophobia, you see that a lot of these stigma and discrimination issues are dealing with hidden realities and hidden truths, and forgetting realities and truths. As you know, all around the world, gays, lesbians, bisexuals, transgender people, intersex people, they face discrimination simply because their sexual orientation or gender identity doesn't fit the standard set by the majority of their society. And in everyday life, LGBTI people may face discrimination in terms of rejection by their family or by the rest of society, but of course also by state authorities. You must know that in 7 countries in the world, legislators have decided to make homosexuality a capital crime. And in about 77 countries in the world, homosexuality is criminalized with prison sentences up to 20 years. I would like to give you, because otherwise it will stay a little vague, I would like to give you 2 concrete examples of HIV people with HIV/AIDS who have been discriminated in their country. My first example is Uganda. In Uganda, homosexuality is criminalized. And on May 2nd, 2008, Mr. Apuli, the Director General of the Uganda AIDS Commission, stated that gays are one of the drivers of HIV in Uganda, but because of meager resources, we cannot direct our programs at them at this time. End of quote. The NGO Sexual Minorities Uganda, SMUG it's called, staged a peaceful protest at the June 2008 HIV/AIDS implementers meeting in Kampala, Uganda. And they said that homophobia drives AIDS and that neglecting the LGBT community drives HIV. Instead of listening to these human rights defenders, they were arrested by the police and they were detained. 2 weeks ago, after they had been released and charged with trespassing the conference compound, 2 weeks ago, one of these human rights defenders was detained again after he left the court building. He was tortured by the police, and while he was being tortured, the police wanted to know about other homosexuals, and they wanted to know about organizations that support HIV/AIDS activists. So in this atmosphere, people with HIV/AIDS have to work, and of course that is a terrible situation. My second example is about Egypt, another horrifying example. Waves of arrests led to the detention of homosexual men in recent months. While in jail, doctors joined the witch hunt and performed mandatory AIDS tests without the consent of the detainees. And the results of these tests and the answers to the questions the doctors asked were included as evidence in the criminal files against these men. Doctors from Egypt's Forensic Medical Authority performed forcible and abusive anal examinations on these men in order to, quote, prove they had had sex with other men. And the prisoners who were tested HIV positive were held in prison hospitals, chained to their beds, and they were treated without any dignity or any respect. And unfortunately, I have to tell you that these arrests are still going on in Egypt as of today. I really think Egypt, the Egyptian government, should be ashamed of itself. If you want further information, you can go to the Human Rights Watch website. In countries where criminalization of homosexuality has been eradicated, it doesn't mean that the LGBTI community is not being discriminated anymore. Homophobia is paramount in many countries in the world. Many of the states who signed human rights treaties, they say, okay, we have signed such a human rights treaty, but actually they are treating it like a menu in a restaurant, because they just pick and they choose. They say, we are in favor of human rights, but not for everybody, not for MSM, for instance. And of course, this is a violation of the basic concept of human rights, because human rights are universal and indivisible, and they apply to everybody, to all human beings. Now, inspired by a meeting with the former High Commissioner for Human Rights, Louisa Arbour, a group of experts on international human rights law convened in the Indonesian city of Yogyakarta. This was at the end of 2006. From all over the world, these experts brought their knowledge and their expertise. They came from Pakistan to Kenya, from Botswana to Thailand, from Europe and Latin America to Nepal, from the United States to China. Many of these experts work within the UN system. And these experts, they codified all existing human rights based on international treaties and jurisprudence, and they translated these existing human rights to sexual orientation and gender identity. What they wrote down was not invented. Everything they codified in the document, and the document is called the Yogyakarta Principles, everything they codified was grounded in existing human rights, law, or jurisprudence. And you must know that the Yogyakarta Principles, hence, are not a wish list, it's not a list of dreams, a summary of dreams. No, they are existing legal rights. For example, Principle 18, it addresses the right to be protected from medical abuses. It's undisputed in the world that all human beings have the right not to be forced to undergo any form of medical or psychological treatment, procedure, testing, or be confined to a medical facility. So it's evident that this right also applies to, let's say, homosexual men or lesbian women. So Egypt is clearly violating this right, Principle 18 of the Yogyakarta Principles. The Yogyakarta Principles, and the hard copy looks like this, and before I forget, I took about 50 hard copies of these Yogyakarta Principles with me. So if you are interested at the end of the session, I'm glad to give you one of the hard copies. In this hard copy, you find 29 principles on the application of international human rights law in relation to sexual orientation and gender identity. And they affirm the primary obligation of states to implement human rights. Each principle is accompanied by detailed recommendations to states and other stakeholders. One of the most important principles is number 2, the rights to equality and non-discrimination. In the recommendations to states, it says that states shall repeal criminal laws that prohibit consensual sexual activities between people of the same sex who are over the age of consent. In my presentation, I would like to focus on Principle 17. And Principle 17 reads as follows. Everyone has the right to the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health without discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. In the recommendation, it says that states shall take all necessary legislative, administrative, and other measures to ensure enjoyment of this right and to ensure that all persons have access to healthcare facilities, to goods and services. Clearly, in the examples, Egypt and Uganda violate this principle. But not only those two countries, also other countries. In countries where a different sexual orientation or gender identity is met by social stigma, like Russia, for instance, or some other Eastern European countries, vulnerable groups like men having sex with men will not be easily reached by AIDS workers. In such a context, people are afraid to come out of the closet. they do not want to incriminate themselves. They do not want to become an outcast in their society. HIV/AIDS programs cannot be effective if not targeted towards these vulnerable groups. So there is severe underreporting, which leads to a higher prevalence within this community and society at large. You've heard all about this at other sessions during this conference. According to data from UNAIDS, it's estimated that at least 5 to 10% of HIV infections worldwide occur through sex between men, though this figure varies considerably between countries and regions. For instance, in the United States, 50% of new infections occur within the homosexual community. In communities where homosexuality is not accepted, MSM also have sex with women while they are living their clandestine lives. The day before yesterday, I attended a meeting about Togo, where there was a presentation about men having sex with men in Togo, and it appears that about 47% of the men who have sex with men in Togo are married and also have sex with women or girls. So it's clear that also girls and women are at risk. On the converse, UNAIDS experience reveals that recognition of the rights of people with different sexual identities, both in law but also in practice, combined with sufficient scaled-up HIV programming to address HIV and health needs, are necessary and complementary components for a successful HIV response. Worldwide, anecdotal evidence highlights that in many countries where sex between males is not criminalized and where stigma and discrimination have been reduced, MSM are more likely to take up HIV prevention, care, and support and treatment services. Now, how to reach the highest attainable standard of health? In order to obtain equal rights and be refrained from discrimination, governments should allow the LGBT community to organize, to express their opinion, to express their sexual orientation without any repercussions, to grant them freedom of assembly, freedom of movement, rights the LGBT community doesn't have, for instance, in Russia at the moment. Capacity building and empowerment of the LGBT community is benevolent for health issues in any given country. So you see that the state of human rights in a country influences the prevalence of HIV/AIDS. And when new policies will be developed to include MSM, transgenders, sex workers, injecting drug users in health programs, it's really crucial that one realizes that these are distinct groups, each with their own history, each with their own social codes. Each group requires specific attention, and effective policies can only be developed with the input of these groups themselves in order to obtain the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health as described in principle number 17. Organizations involved in planning global and regional HIV responses, like country coordinating mechanisms and national AIDS control plans, must ensure that HIV-related services are available to MSM and that funds dedicated to these services at a national level are proportionate to the impact of HIV on MSM in that specific country. National AIDS commissions and other bodies should monitor the way the money is spent. In order to develop adequate policies, it's important to include MSM in national surveillance and independent epidemiological and behavioral research studies. Only such an approach amounts to the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health as is listed in Principle 17 of the Yogyakarta Principles. So let me conclude, because I know that my time is up. Actually, I call upon all participants to put pressure to their governments to end criminalization and also to end discrimination of people on the basis of their sexual orientation or gender identity. It's not only because sexual minorities are, like everybody else, entitled to non-discrimination and equality, but also because it improves their health and that of the broader society. Yesterday, I was invited to attend a meeting of members of parliament. It was organized by the International Parliamentary Union. And as you know, there are many members of parliament from all over the world attending this conference. And they use a guide to HIV/AIDS. I guess, and I think it's really important, that you as NGO members, for instance, that you target these members of parliament who are here at a conference, and that you talk with them about, for instance, why do you still criminalize homosexuality in your country? And don't accept the answer, please don't accept the answer, that homosexuality is against culture or tradition or religion, because we are talking about human rights. Our human rights should be available for everybody. Thank you very much, and if you would like to have a hard copy of the Yogyakarta Principles, please come and collect it. There is also a website, and it's www.yogyakartaprinciples.org. And on this website, you can read the Yogyakarta Principles in all the official UN languages, and within the near future, also in a few other languages. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Boris. And I will add to calling upon the government to decriminalize homosexuality that change depends on all of us. And ourselves, we should start fighting stigma. We shouldn't take it. We should fight stigma discrimination against us and against people around us. Before moving to our fourth presentation, I would like to take two questions from the public. Questions? You have to move to the lady for the mic.
Yes, I have a question, two questions in fact, for the presenter from Ghana. The first one is, you said that sexual relations between men is unnatural according to the law. On the other hand, you have activities in some hospitals with government staff that have been sensitized to work with MSM. I'm quite interested because I think this is a kind of gateway into working in difficult environments. How did it happen? What are the conditions? Are the conditions that it should be low profile also? And then the second question is, how come that gay people were less stigmatized after your interventions? Could you clarify that? Thank you.
Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Hello, hello, hello. Yes, I must say that our program is a collaborative one with the Ghana Health Service, who are already working on some most at-risk population. And so the capacity of these medical people and nurses were built to accept MSM.
So that is what makes it easier. But the government do not accept homosexuals. And we also have to acknowledge the fact that most of our activities are done still underground. And then our communities, we have the police coming in, coming to our office, and they want to know what we do. And they come and have meetings in front of our office, and they will be pointing at the office. You don't know what they talk about, and then everyone gets scared. But it just tells you how powerful peer education approach works. Because the peer educators are supposed to only talk to their peers. We do not have problems with the law and talking to straight man or any homophobic person on the street.
Thank you, Magdali. A second question.
Hi, my name is Soyeon Im from the HIV Vaccine Trials Network. First of all, I really enjoyed all of the talks. I'm from the USA, where the gay community is very open in relation. So it's very interesting and very sad for me to hear these stories. My question is for Zorian from Ukraine. I went to another session where a researcher from China was talking about the MSM in Guangzhou, and he mentioned that most of the MSM were very young and low income and low education, and they were kind of floating as well. They didn't have permanent homes. And I wonder if that's the situation in Ukraine as well, because, you know, because of all the discrimination and stigma, I wonder if this leads to a lot of the young MSM leaving their homes and having unstable situations overall, and if that, you know, that probably leads to even bigger problems.
Thank you very much for the question, and I don't have an easy answer for it, because we still need more research about this situation and we don't have it now. But from my experience and from what I know, this is very much like in Ukraine, because lots of young MSM would leave their home or would not be accepted by their parents and will have to leave their homes. And they will be attracted to big cities such as Kyiv or Odessa, and they would sell sex for food or housing. And this is very much like so in Ukraine. And I have seen myself lots of young MSM in cruising areas in the city of Kyiv where I live. But thank you for this question, and I think I will try to initiate the research of this situation in Ukraine after I come back. Thank you very much. If this answers your question.
Before moving to our fourth presentation, I would just like to add a comment to what Magdalene said. I know it's not my place. There have always been a clash in Africa and in most of countries where there have been some research on MSM and HIV. There have been a clash between the political will and the will to make things change by health practitioners. And in countries like Senegal, where homosexuality is illegal, we've seen that they've introduced men who have sex with men as a vulnerable population in their strategic plan to fight HIV and AIDS. This was done by health practitioners who believed that by including these people and addressing the issue, they would fight HIV and AIDS, while the government do not necessarily have the political will to decriminalize homosexuality. And now we'll have to move on to Rao Kavi from India. He will be presenting on the invisibility of a core high risk group. The title of his presentation is The Journey of India's Colorful Communities of Marginalized Sexualities, Waking Up to the Genocide of HIV and AIDS. Thank you.
First of all, let me apologize. I had to leave the podium because I was not well. So I think I'm okay, a little steady. It's very interesting because the presentations up to now have given you a very good idea that because of stigma and discrimination, there is a great difficulty. It's a barrier to working with these populations, especially where HIV/AIDS and STI control is there. I'm going to take you to an overview of one of the oldest civilizations, because I don't consider India a country. It's more than a country. It's a civilization. And I start... I don't see my presentation there. Something wrong? Yes, there you are. I'm going to start with a small personal story. This is a picture taken through the window of a taxi somewhere in 2001. And it's a transgendered sister of mine looking through the window. She was begging at the traffic junction. And she belonged to the ethno-religious cult called Hijras, who are transgendered, male to female, transgendered. And it's very interesting, because though they are in your face, and the paradox is that they're so visible, there is no enumeration or census figure for this minority of men who don't identify as males at all. So I start from there. She came to work for my organization as a peer. Unfortunately, she was already HIV positive. That time there was no ART treatment in the government public hospitals. And she died with us 2 years after that, in 2003. I just wanted this face to remain in your memory, so you won't forget what's happening to huge numbers of Indians today. India, next slide. India has always historically had a tradition of men having sex with men. In Hinduism, for example, God is recognized as unlimited and not tethered by gender restrictions. The oldest literature of mankind, the Vedas, for example, mention concepts of third sex, men who are not, or males who are not really identifying as men. The words used are napunsaka, which are still used, shanda. Real warriors are not supposed to fight with these men. And they have a sacred status in much of the rituals. In fact, there are transgendered gods, homosexual gods. And last year, one of the temples had nearly 4.5 million single men visiting it. The god called Hariharaputra, which means the son of Shiva and Vishnu. And the Ayyappa shrine is one of the most sacred shrines in India. A lot of men go there. So however much these shrines and gods are attacked by the modern Indians, secularists, Marxists, fundamentalists of all kinds, they still remain. And that's the wonder of India. And it's so much in your face. And yet, over the last 20 years, what we are seeing is slowly the rise in the public health landscape of these minorities, which nobody seems to know about. The last size estimate, which I did for the National AIDS Control Organization, gives you a floor figure of 2.35 million men having sex with men who are vulnerable. We are not talking of men who identify as homosexual or as transgender. We are talking from the public health point of view. And that alone is 2.35 million. Now, if you see, let's get back into the public health phase. I'm trying to give you a very quick, broad overview so that you can then ask me questions and I can clarify. The first AIDS case was detected in India in 1986. And soon, HIV was reported from almost all states and union territories of the country. There was a National AIDS Committee set up. And soon after, India was one of the first countries which had a vertical National AIDS Control Organization that sat in Delhi and really had a control over all the national state AIDS control societies. It's very interesting to point out to you that health is a sector that is only handled by each state. And India seriously takes its federal structure. So Delhi actually talking down to each state was not really liked. Even today there are tensions in the health sector between the center or the federal government and the state government. But it's still
they're trying to work together. The first and second national AIDS control programs, which are called NACP, were launched in 1989 and 1999 respectively. You will be surprised to know that in 1989, I was there at Montreal, and there was a bureaucrat from the health ministry who actually made a statement that there were no homosexuals in India. It reminds you of Iran's president, right? This happened in 1989. And soon now you're seeing that it's a core population. So what was the transition? What happened? From that period, the first pilot projects were started hesitatingly in 1999. My organization, the Hamsafar Trust, was one of the first which got the pilot in the whole country to work with just 1,000 men. And the first stories that came out of the HIV prevalence in STIs were horror stories. It was 13.8% as a baseline figure. And some of the other indicators, condom use was pathetic, 20%. Health-seeking behavior was 30%. The number of partners per month was 11 on an average of casual partners. We're not talking of lovers. So you can see that as NACP, that is the National AIDS Control Program's progress, a slow and steady rise in the consciousness that there was this population and how were we to engage it? Because it's a paradox. Everybody knows that there are sexual minorities in India. Many of these sexual minorities are treated as sacred. They are part of the social religious landscape. And yet the government was not conceding that they are a very intricate and important part of the public health issue around AIDS control. The focus was on heterosexual contact, injecting drug use, and mother-to-child transmission and transfusion of unsafe blood. Today, from the time the first sentinel surveillances were done all over the country, today India has 1,700 sentinel surveillance sites, and they're expected to double in the next 5 years. So you can imagine the government is very serious. Of these, only 46 centers are for men having sex with men exclusively and for transgender. So the focus was on female sex workers and injecting drug users. The NACO site, which is a very, it's transparent in the sense, it's never updated usually, but doesn't matter. It kept on insisting that 98% of the transmission was heterosexual. And HIV transmission through anal intercourse among MSM and transgenders was not considered at all as a route for HIV transmission. It was in NACP3, that is in 2003-2004, when people like me from communities who were shouting on television, who brought television programs to a standstill, who went into parliament and lobbied with members of parliament, that they started really worrying, because there were issues here not only regarding human rights, with that's very important, but the fact is that NACP3 was a very serious effort at getting in all these communities which are at risk. That's the wonderful part about the Indian government. It always wakes up at the 11th hour. So NACO acknowledged, that is the National AIDS Control Organization, acknowledged MSM and transgendered as one of the three core high-risk populations. That's after nearly 15 to 18 years of a National AIDS Control Program in progress. And according to the 2006 Sentinel surveillance data, over 90% of HIV transmission was due to unprotected vaginal and anal sex. That's when it came in. That was the first shock. And it was brought in by epidemiologists of the National AIDS Research Institute in Pune, which is, again, a premier institute. India, I can proudly say, had established an institute only for HIV-AIDS, research. And that, when it sort of threw it on the table, that anal sex was very much a high-risk behavior. It had to be considered. In India, anal sex is not considered sex at all. It's considered to be musty mischief. So, even bringing it to that level was difficult. Yeah. Much of the transmission, it was established, occurred within groups or networks of individuals, and there came in other implications of homophobia, the silent genocide among MSM and TG, with TG communities with 49% HIV prevalence. As MSM and TG population size was not enumerated, not ascertained, not sort of even got a grip upon. HIV prevalence rates as established by the government can be questioned. According to the independent surveys, a little over 40% of HIV burden among the high-risk groups is carried by MSM and transgender population alone. The role of the community-based groups that the MSM and TG organizations have now become the central in the government AIDS programs. How quickly we've come to the center of the stage. Massive advocacy efforts are on with the police. I've talked to the Commission of Police, to the judges of the Supreme Court, the High Courts, and you'll be surprised there isn't the type of homophobia that we expected. They are willing to listen, but they don't know how to get at it. Discrimination, social exclusion of MSM, from human rights abuses and service denial. The community's role is now central in trying to remove the anti-sodomy laws that came in during the time of the British. You can imagine. The British brought in the anti-sodomy laws. India never had anti-sodomy laws for 4,000 years. And suddenly in 200 years, you had whole groups of gay men, transgender, criminalized. Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to your questions. Thank you.
Stigma and discrimination drives the spread of HIV. 15 minutes for questions.
Hello?
Joseph, move towards the mic.
My name is Joseph, and my question goes to the Kenyan representative and the representative from Ukraine. In your presentation, which I would say is very remarkable thing that you're doing in your various countries, I didn't really get what you do in terms of young gay men or men who assist with men who are homeless, because I feel that this group of people are the ones who are more vulnerable to HIV infection. Thank you.
Second question.
I just wanted to bring out, I think it's great that you're at least trying to push your governments and your localities to push for better data collection. My name is Rob Sacquaton from the U.S. I guess just a couple of statements, actually. Even though I guess people think of the U.S. as maybe one of the more forward countries in terms of LGBT rights, we've lost a lot of ground under George W. Bush. I think the latest thing that happened is that the next U.S. Census that comes up in 2010, they have been instructed not to count couples that mark themselves as married because they got legally married in Massachusetts and California, so they want to deny the existence of our marriages and our relationships. And also, LGBT activists in the U.S. were successful in getting basically basic information about our health outcomes on the Healthy People 2010, which is basically the guideline for 10 years for how how health resources are allocated and researched in the U.S. But since then, since Bush came to power, basically that's been a standstill. And I guess the other thing I want to remind you is that even though it looks like you're making progress with rights, beware of backlashes. Because that is, the best example is with Canada after gay marriage was instituted, where there was a lot of political backlash and an increase in gay bashing and violence.
Thank you. We take a third question. We'll allow the presenters to reply before taking other questions. On the other side.
Thank you. I'm Dira Moya from Mauritius. I want to ask my colleagues from India about if they get support from religion leaders for your organization for the against discrimination and stigmatization. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you. We start. You?
Just to, I must confess that there's lots of gay men on the streets of Accra who have been sacked from homes, who are coming from the other regions and are walking on the streets of Accra selling sex. Like I said, one of the challenges of our program is funding. We have plans in place to work with gay sex workers in Accra, and then migrants from Liberia and then war-torn zones who come to Ghana, and then they also find sex work as the only means to survive. So we have a lot of work.
I would like to thank for the questions. And in terms of homeless MSM, I would like to say that we don't do much for Ukraine, for MSM in general, I have to admit. Our programs in Ukraine have just started last year in 10 regions of Ukraine, including Kyiv and Odessa, which, as I mentioned, are the cities that most homeless MSM are attracted to. So, and I also have to say that the programs in Ukraine and other Eastern European countries are more general and are not yet specialized for homeless MSM, for MSM of specific age, for MSM of specific ethnic groups, or for MSM of specific cultures. And we are coming to that, but so far we are just starting. And thank you for the idea of working with homeless MSM. It has been around in Ukraine for a long period of time. But again, we need funding and models, successful models. So if anyone can share a successful model of work with homeless MSM, I will appreciate that. And I would like also to give a short comment on the comment of our colleague from the United States. Thank you for this comment. We have also always be aware of the fact that there will always be backlashes and there will always be homophobia. And even in developed countries, we have to always work, because homophobia is there, and it's not that it's only in the Eastern European countries or those countries who are just starting the work. It's everywhere, and we have to work always.
Yes, I would also like to comment on the question, or actually the remark, of the gentleman from the United States. The Netherlands was the first country to introduce same-sex marriage and adoption by gay couples. But strangely enough, after that had been achieved, you hear a lot of comments by the general public that they don't really believe there is any discrimination anymore, because they say, but you have gay marriages. So it's very important to try to show the general public that there are discrimination areas, and that it's very important to address these issues, and that gay marriage shouldn't be used as some kind of token, but it's of course one part of human rights that has been established in the Netherlands. But indeed, homophobia is everywhere, and also in the Netherlands, specifically in certain groups. So actually, you have to fight homophobia every day, everywhere.
I'm not sure I agree that there's general homophobia that you see in Europe and America and India. What there is compulsory heterosexuality, you see. Your homosexual identity could be way out on the table. There are members of parliament who are openly homosexual. But as long as they have done their social duties, nobody really cares about your sexuality. There's a very strange paradox that the Madras High Court has actually taken for inheritance laws marriage between the third gender or transgender and a male as legal. There are scores of lesbian marriages in India, definitely marginalized more than the men. They seem to have more courage than the men in going forward and getting married in temples. There isn't any basic hatred for the... I don't see that as lesbophobia. What they are protesting, the mainstream, is that you have to get married in a heterosexual paradigm. So how I would like to argue that out would be another discourse altogether. But it's important to put that on the table.
Thank you. We'll take three other questions. Starts from my right.
Hi, I'm Maria Ekstrand, University of California, San Francisco. I have a question for Ashok. Thank you for a very interesting overview. I noticed on your slides that you had combined all the data for gay men and transgenders, and it seems to me, based on your description of the two groups, that they are actually very different, and I would expect that risk behaviors and prevalences would be different for the two. Do you have the data broken down?
Thank you, Maria, for pointing that out. Actually, when the Sentinel surveillances started for MSM, the whole under that umbrella, transgendered were lumped in. And the transgendered community took very strong objection, because in India they consider themselves not men and therefore totally separate. Hence, in the operational guidelines for the future NACP3, it was I and my group which suggested that it should now be termed MSM and transgender. And the only Sentinel surveillance site where desegregated data comes in was really Bombay. And after that, now Bangalore has started. The differences are so amazing, in the sense that three times higher HIV prevalence among transgendered males compared to MSM, whose identity is not around gender. But again, there's a problem, Maria, in the sense that there are fluid identities in India, where MSM, there are identities which are between MSM and transgender, who call themselves double-deckers. There are Koti identities, and there are more than about 8 or 9 identities that are fluid. And what we're talking of hijra identity is those belonging to the religious ethnic cult. There are lots of transgender who don't fall in that identity and don't want to be known as hijras. So there is a complex situation here. But you're very right, when we desegregated the data, it was another horror story. I mean, in Bombay, it was 8.5% among men having sex with men, and among hijras, it was 26%. So, you know, you can't neglect the differences. Thank you, but for asking, yeah.
We'll move to our left.
Hi, Sean Casey from Heartland Alliance in the U.S. Following up on a previous question that raised the issue that many MSM that you're reaching in your organizations are young or low income and or vulnerable for other reasons. So I'm curious to ask I want to ask the three implementing individuals up there, how you reach those rich, well-connected, not vulnerable MSM who exist in every country but who don't want to have contact with LGBT organizations, who don't want to be reached because it might out them and it might risk their social capital. And I also wanted to know if any of you have done operational research through your MSM prevention interventions to know what has worked in terms of behavior change and perhaps what hasn't. Thanks.
Then all right.
Yes, I just have a quick question about the Yogyakarta principles. And I'm wondering if there's been any conversations or if you have any recommendations on monitoring and reporting and perhaps enforcement of the important document that you've talked about.
Next.
I'll try to make this quick. When I walk around the pharmaceutical booth and I look at the imagery, I was speaking to some folks there, and the imagery internationally always is I'm not saying they shouldn't be there, of women and their children, or, you know, but when I talk to somebody who I actually know that works for one of the companies, they said, well, we do MSM stuff locally. I said, well, what about internationally? Because this is an international issue. And in that, when we sort of become sanitized when we become international, and those that come from countries that don't, are not represented, aren't seen in those images, and therefore we're perpetuating the thing that we're trying to fight against in order to please their shareholders that make, you know, we don't want to piss them off so they don't make money.
Thank you. We'll take the last questions, then allow the panelists to respond.
Hi, my name is Carmen Logie. I'm from the University of Toronto. 13 days ago, I met with the Sexual Minorities of Uganda, SMUG, which is one of the case studies. And that was 2 days before one of their members was detained and tortured. And what I was struck by was that so many organizations receive UNAIDS funding, yet refuse to work in the Ugandan context with sex workers or MSM. And including the Foundation for Human Rights, whose executive director says they do not support the rights of gay and lesbian people. So how do we hold these, how can UNAIDS funding, which is supposed to be supporting the rights of MSM and sex workers, how do we hold organizations accountable to provide these services, especially when you're talking about federal human rights agencies. Thank you.
Who starts?
Yes, I must also say here that our program had a training for two old liaison MSM who are a bit wealthy, and then they organized different intervention programs. They organized parties, group discussions, and which is separate from the peer education programs. And then we, the office, our office go and have discussions with these groups. And but there are those who would not even want to be associated with the program, and we are still working in the process to get someone within their class to speak to them.
I will try to be brief because, as I see, we are running out of time. And the, in terms of the question, how do we reach? How do we reach MSM? My previous answer answers this question that our programs are not yet very specialized. But to my opinion, the only way to reach MSM is through business venues such as clubs and nightclubs and bars. And in Ukraine, we do face lots of problems with them because we are accused by the gay business that we are interfering with their business with. Trying to do any prevention work or any information work in that. So this is a challenge in Ukraine. And I, regarding the other question about operational research, I will have to make a clarification here that my organization, the Network of People Who Live with HIV, does mainly national level advocacy and care and support programs for HIV-positive MSM. The prevention programs are implemented in Ukraine mostly by the International HIV-AIDS Alliance in Ukraine, and they do operational researches, and I think they are available on their website. But still, we don't have that much. The programs for MSM don't run in Ukraine for such a long time that we can have any data on what works and what doesn't. So we still have to work for a longer period of time to know what really does work. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the question about monitoring and enforcement of the Yogyakarta principles. What I can say is that actually all stakeholders in a specific country should put pressure on their own government to endorse the Yogyakarta principles and to implement human rights for vulnerable groups in such a country. But on an international level, I can tell you that the Yogyakarta principles were introduced by Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay in November 2007 at the United Nations. Yesterday morning, I had a meeting with the Mexican government. Also, Mexico is using the Yogyakarta principles. I can tell you that the European Parliament voted in favor of a resolution to end discrimination, and in this resolution, reference is made to the Yogyakarta principles. There are specific parliaments and governments who endorse the Yogyakarta principles, like the Netherlands and Belgium. And I'd like actually also to announce that in the first week of December, in the General Assembly at the United Nations in New York, there will be taken an initiative presented by France, but it's a cross-regional initiative, and it will be a declaration on ending discrimination in terms of sexual orientation and gender identity. And of course, that's not the same as a resolution by the United Nations endorsing the Yogyakarta principles, but it's a step on the way to that goal. You must realize that, for instance, at the Human Rights Council in Geneva, a majority of the countries that are member of the Human Rights Council do not even want to discuss sexual orientation or gender identity. So we are still far away from this goal, but it's a major challenge, and one day we will get there.
I think I have to answer in two parts. The first is, of course, operational research. my mother organization, the Hamsafar Trust, works on approximately 215 sex sites in Bombay City, but these are public sex sites. We do not get to the rich MSM who themselves have seeded from the organization. The organization remains open to all classes and castes and communities. But if you refuse to come there because you feel that, oh, only the poor go there, then it's not our fault. Then you can go to a richer hospital where you can get the services you want. We have approximately 8 research projects going, flowing out of our huge outreach program and STI referrals to public hospitals. And some of them are very important in the sense they've never been thought of in the public health sector, like what is the mental baseline? Why do men having sex with men have such a large number of multiple partners? Although it's politically incorrect to ask it, but it is a very important indicator in HIV prevalence. And therefore that is operational research we have. We have other operational researches that are going where what is the impediment to condom use? Why do men not use condoms? Is it accessibility? Is it because of lack of pleasure? So all these are going on simultaneously in parallel with the outreach program. Secondly, regarding the human rights, I feel that a lot of us who are working at grassroots level understand that there is a need to marry human rights, because without human rights coming into your outreach and your public health program, really there's no use working on empowering MSM and gay men and transgender. So they're on two tracks. On one hand, you do the work around health issues, and on the other track there will be gay organizations and MSM organizations or lawyers organizations which work around human rights issues of sexual minorities. And that's what's happening in India, because if I were to work on health issues, which is not my expertise or my core competency, I will be really letting out the prevention program out of hand. And I'll be having very few MSM who would be thinking of human rights. At the same time, the human rights organizations are looking at HIV issues. And we have a very comprehensive HIV/AIDS bill in India that's coming up. I'm not very sure the members of parliament are very enthusiastic about it. But it has principles of the Yogyakarta principles that were married into it. But they are concerning HIV/AIDS as a public health issue. So I would like to, that's where it stands today in India. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Boris, Zorian, Ashok, and Magdalene. We've come to the end of our session. Thank you for coming.